The Lord be with you.
Also with you.
Let us pray. O Father of all people and ruler of nations, who would have all people to dwell together in peace and unity, raise up, we ask you, leaders in every land who will choose peace instead of war, and direct their people in pathways of friendship and understanding toward others. Help us all in our respective places to seek justice, to cultivate righteousness, and to walk humbly before you. Remove all pride from our hearts. Give us understanding minds so that regardless of race or nationality, color or station in life, we may realize that we are all of the same flesh and blood, your common creation. Restrain the efforts of those who would sow seeds of hatred and ill will among nations. Bless all efforts for peace. Direct the course of this world, that your will may be done and your kingdom come. Cause quiet and order to prevail everywhere, that the message of your gospel may, without any obstacle or hindrance, be carried to the far corners of the earth. For the sake of him who died and rose again, that we might live forever. Amen. Okay, and then I'd like to also share with you a reading from Romans, the 13th chapter. And it concerns obedience to authority and also concerns the fulfillment of the law through love. Let every person be subordinate to the higher authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been established by God. Therefore, whoever resists authority opposes what God has appointed, and those who oppose it will bring judgment upon themselves. For rulers are not a cause of fear to good conduct, but to evil. Do you wish to have no fear of authority? Then do what is good, and you will receive approval from it, for it is a servant of God for your good. But if you do evil, be afraid, for it does not bear the sword without purpose. It is the servant of God to inflict wrath on the evildoer. Therefore, it is necessary to be subject not only because of the wrath, but also because of conscience. This is why you also pay taxes, for the authorities are ministers of God, devoting themselves to this very thing. Pay to all their dues, taxes to whom taxes are due, toll to whom toll is due, respect to whom respect is due, honor to whom honor is due. Owe nothing to anyone except to love one another. For the one who loves another has fulfilled the law. The commandments: you shall not commit adultery, you shall not kill, you shall not steal, you shall not covet, and whatever other commandment there may be, are summed up in this saying: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Love does no evil to the neighbor. Hence, love is the fulfillment of the law. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Okay, so on the occasion of Martin Luther's day, of course, it makes sense to pray for justice and for God to bless all efforts towards peace. Coming out of a discussion on active righteousness, it makes sense to think of justice. Coram hominibus, justice coram mundo. And so efforts directed towards that ought to be praised. So there is something to the Miss Universe pageants always saying that we should pray for world peace, I guess. And so that's okay. We can do that. At the same time, we have our reading here talking about obedience to the government and how the temporal authorities have been placed in their offices by God. Of course, not every worldly leader is worthy of the office. I suppose you could say something similar to those who hold a pastoral office. And so there is, of course, room for discernment as to who is fulfilling their duty to the neighbor. In any case, the offices, though, have been established by God independently or who occupies it at this or that time. It's sort of like when Luther also calls the Pope the Antichrist. Well, the point is not that this or that particular Pope might get his feelings hurt. Some of them might actually do better than others in regards to the proclamation of the gospel, but the main point is that the critique goes to anybody who sets any office that would put his authority above the word of God. And so you can't do that if you're serving in the pastoral ministry as a shepherd of God's people. But anyways, so some, again, a prayer and a text from Scripture that helps us to begin to think about what we're going to talk about here today and then discuss on Thursday. Is that it? Yeah, Thursday. And it's this Lutheran discussion of the two realms or the two kingdoms, Lutheran discussion of living in God's two realms. Okay, so we'll want to talk about that today. And the first point that I always like to make when I talk about this is that the whole world is the sphere of God's activity. Okay? So if we want to talk about kingdom, we want to talk about ruling, we want to talk about governing, the first point to be made is that God is king over all, or as some people might say, God rules. God rules, man. Okay, so God is king. Let's take that as our starting point and see what this means in relationship to the whole world. So let's establish that to begin with. Yahweh is portrayed in the Old Testament as one who is king over all creation. All right, so let's not privatize anything here. God is above all, over all the earth, the nations, and kings. So, Psalm 47, for example. God is king over all the earth. Sing hymns of praise. God rules over the nations. God sits upon his holy throne. For the rulers of the earth belong to God, who is enthroned on high. So, whether this or that particular nation, or whether this or that particular ruler does not rarely come out and acknowledge either God's existence or God's power, things that would be readily available simply on the basis of being created, I suppose, natural law, it doesn't matter. Yahweh is still God over all creation, which means that by virtue of simply existing, by virtue of being created, we already stand in a relationship of dependence to God. That's whether you acknowledge it or not. And so God always runs the show. No nation, no ruler is above God or in some kind of duel with God. God can use any and all in creation to do His will. And He does. So God is King over all creation. Sometimes this is often referred to in catechetical terms as the kingdom of power. All right? This ruling, this governing of God over all peoples of the earth, over all nations, over all kings, princes, presidents, whatever you want to call those who rule. Often, in God's ruling, He also comes against false gods of the nations, false idols, whatever those might be, either individually or collectively. And this is also clear in the Old Testament. So, for example, Psalm 96, "For great is the Lord and highly to be praised, to be feared above all gods, for the gods of the nations all do nothing, but the Lord made the heavens." So God's sovereignty, God's kingly rule over creation extends also to a struggle against any idols that want to be set above Him. And just one more example here specifically. It's not only that God rules through the kings of the earth, but also He can rule against the wicked. And so, you know, anyone who goes into the service of God's people through a temporal office in government would do well to read something like this. "How long, Lord, shall the wicked glory? How long will they mouth haughty speeches, go on boasting, all these evildoers? They crush your people, Lord, torment your very own. They kill the widow and alien, the fatherless they murder. Can unjust judges be your allies? Those who create burdens in the name of the law, those who conspire against the just and condemn the innocent to death, who will turn back their evil upon them and destroy them for their wickedness? Surely the Lord our God will destroy them." So again, it's another aspect of God's sovereignty, kingly rule above the nations of the earth and their leaders and all their false idols. All right, so in a sense then, you could talk about God's kingdom of power over peoples, nations, governments, rulers. And one of the things to note is that when this dimension of God's identity, that of the king, comes up in the Old Testament, it's also set against, over and against, the anti-kingdom, you might say. And the anti-kingdom here will be the idols that are set before the people and over against God the Creator, and also set against those who do evil. So in this case, for example, from Psalms, the wicked rulers. So Satan is at work in the world, leading people to raise up idols to lead their nations at this or that point in history. Satan is at work in the world, leading to the oppression of many, often the killing of many, the going of or the warring of one tribe against another. All these things could be seen also as a manifestation of the activity of Satan in the world. And so God's kingdom of power is often brought about sort of in opposition to these forces. Okay, there is a theologian by the name of Gustav Aulen, who was brought up in class before by Dr. Kolb in connection to something else. But he talks about God's establishing of his kingdom in the world, and that to do so, what God often does is not only can he subdue evil powers, but also he might even be able to use them for his own purposes. Okay, but often we have to recognize that that activity is often hidden from us. So sometimes you might see some government as idolatrous because they might have a particular policy of, you know, I don't know, nationalism or mercantilism, or the rights of a society are put above individual rights or something like that. And then you might say, well, that doesn't look that God is at work there. It all looks like the work of Satan. Well, then you have to ask questions like, well, is free trade or individual rights above rights of society the God that we're going to follow, you know? Is that the better thing? Is that not an idol? Could it not become an idol? You know? Or socialism, capitalism, these kinds of things. You know, so we have to be careful that we don't necessarily right away jump and try to find out where God is at work through this or that government. That could very easily become a kind of theologian of glory move, right? Because he will be looking for God's presence and activity where he has not clearly revealed himself. Okay? So what we're simply affirming, though, is that however things look like in the world, one thing is for sure, and that is that God is in charge. Okay? And he often subdues evil powers, and he often uses them in order to establish his will. Although it is not often very clear to us how he precisely does that. Okay, and it's even often not very clear to us how exactly Satan or the anti-kingdom involved in the world. Often one sort of knows what's happening when it's perhaps a little bit too overt and perhaps even a little bit too late. Who knows? Well, one thinks, for example, of Nazi Germany. There were many people who didn't see what was coming. I remember there was a professor here who used to teach Latin and German. Professor, I think Schmidt was his last name. Very nice man, excellent teacher, and he grew up during the time of World War II, and he used to say, well, you know, we didn't know all the stuff that was going on. Came to find out a little bit too late. So everyone in this Lutheran school, for him growing up, were all sort of a little bit pro-German kind of thing, you know. And then, well, that stopped in a hurry, you know. Or there were Catholics, too, in Bavaria, Germany, who supported a government policy under the Third Reich simply because they had this kind of nationalistic move and sort of the concern for the Germans. And they have been, I suppose, suffering in many ways from what they saw as the effects of the presence of people from other nations among them, I suppose, including the Jews. But that is not to say that they were in agreement with how the Jews were dealt with. See, and so in other words, or sometimes, you know, I think there are many of these examples, you know, where it doesn't seem like God is in charge. Okay? But right now, what we want to establish is that God is king. Of course, this deals to all kinds of theology questions and so on. But right now, as a starting point, I simply want to establish the idea of God's sovereignty and rule, which extends not only to the people of Israel or something like that, but is often defended and is often confessed in the Old Testament as a rule over all people. So you can't say something like, you know, God is at work only in some parts of the world. Or God should be at work only in some parts of the world because some of us are actually doing pretty well. So we need a little bit more God over on that side of things. Well, God simply rules. And he often does it over and against the forces of the anti-kingdom in the world. So that's the kingdom of power, okay? God punishes evildoers. God rewards good behavior, justice. And this happens often through, well, offices, temporal authority. We'll get into that in a little bit more. But also in the Old Testament, you have another kind of sovereignty, another kind of ruling that God is also said to establish, is said to establish in the world, and that is kinship through the work of the servant. The servant of Yahweh in Isaiah is, of course, in light of the New Testament, Christ. And so God is kin through his servant. And here's a text from one of the servant songs in Isaiah that brings that out. Here is my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one with whom I am pleased, upon whom I have put my spirit. Part of these words were used at the baptism of Christ. He shall bring forth justice to the nations. I, the Lord, set you as a covenant of the people, a light for the nations. To open the eyes of the blind, to bring out prisoners from confinement and from the dungeon, those who live in darkness. So Isaiah has this Exodus kind of language. But it doesn't apply it only to Israel. It applies it to all the nations. So it's one of these things that's called a universal monotheism. What that means is that just as Yahweh freed his people from the oppression of Pharaoh, so also will Yahweh reveal his power, his ruling over all nations, but this will happen through the ministry of the servant. And so there will be a second Exodus, if you want to put it that way, where all the nations will know that Yahweh is their God. Okay? But this will not happen except through the ministry of the servant, which, as we know from Isaiah, is not only about the exaltation of the servant, but before that is about the death of the servant who takes upon himself, bears upon himself the sins of the people. Okay? Now, in catechetical terms, this is often called the kingdom of grace. All right? So the kingdom of power is God's rule over all nations to punish the wicked rulers, to punish the evildoers, and also to reward those who uphold the cause of justice, whether those are rulers or those are citizens of the world. All right? But in the kingdom of grace, we have something different here. Same God, same Yahweh, but now he's establishing his kingdom through the work of the servant, which is seen as a work that brings people into a relationship with God, a covenant with God. It is spoken of as bringing a light to the nations or to the Gentiles. And it is spoken of also in terms of the struggle against the anti-kingdom, opening the eyes of the blind, bringing out prisoners from confinement, and those who live in darkness. So the language almost sounds like Luke 4, quoting Isaiah 61, right? The Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me to proclaim good news, bring recovery of sight to the blind, proclaim a favorable year of the Lord, you know, set captives free, this kind of work. God is ruling again. It's the same Yahweh, but now he's ruling through his Christ in order to bring his salvation to all. We have this language also in Isaiah 49. It is too little for you to be my servant, to raise up the tribes of Jacob and restore the survivors of Israel. I will make you a light to the nations, that my salvation may reach to the ends of the earth. Okay? Kingdom of grace is bringing you basically into the kingdom of the Son through the forgiveness of sins. That's the kingdom of grace. Colossians 1. The Father deliver us from the power of darkness and transfer us to the kingdom of his beloved Son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. This kingdom that Yahweh brings about to forgive sins, kingdom which he brings about through Christ and the work of the servant, is also described as a kingdom that has to be established in a struggle against the forces of the anti-kingdom. All right? And in catechetical terms, as the struggle against sin, death, and the devil. You get a picture of this, for example, in Matthew 12. Christ there is healing a deaf, mute, demon-possessed man. And the way he describes his work is really in terms of this kingdom language, that where the kingdom of God established through Christ, and that's manifested in this case through the healing and the exorcism, no one else can rule. There can be no other king. If Satan drives out Satan, some were saying that Christ was doing this by the power of Beelzebub, remember? But if Satan drives out Satan, he's divided against himself. How then will his kingdom stand? So here's the anti-kingdom, as it were. But if it is by the Spirit of God that I drive out demons, then the kingdom of God has come upon you. So Yahweh's gracious rule through Christ is established over against the anti-kingdom, or Satan, who wants to keep everyone in bondage to sin and death. So, to sum up this brief sort of sketch from the Old Testament and then the New on God's kinship, we may say this: that God rules in the world by his power and also by his grace. Kingdom of power, kingdom of grace, one king. But we get a sense already that there is a distinction between these two kingdoms, if you want to put it that way. Same king, same God, same world. But this king is establishing his rule for two different purposes, in two different ways. One is to establish his kingdom in the world with the power of the sword, we might say, to establish justice, to punish the wicked, okay, for the sake of peace and tranquility, and hopefully so that there might be no obstacles for the proclamation of the gospel, okay? But God also rules in this world through his Christ and by the power of his Spirit in order to bring people into a covenant relationship with Yahweh through the forgiveness of sins. There we may say God rules by His Word, by His Gospel, okay, transforming the hearts of sinners so that they might come to faith in Christ and now belong to the kingdom of the Son through the redemption, the forgiveness of sins. Okay, so again, same King, Yahweh rules, yes, He rules by the power of the sword, but He also rules by grace through His Word. So already we see a sense of the distinction here between what we call the two kingdoms in Lutheran theology. So once again, it appears that Lutheran theology does have its biblical basis. That's a good thing, isn't it? All right, two kingdoms. Luther at times can speak of the kingdom of Christ as the kingdom of grace, and that makes sense. We just saw the text from Colossians talking about belonging to the kingdom of the Son. How? Through the forgiveness of sins. All right, so Luther can speak of the kingdom of grace as the kingdom of Christ. Okay? So when we say something like, "Thy kingdom come," Luther in the Large Catechism would say that Christ and His Spirit might come into our lives to bring us to the Father through the forgiveness of sins. All right? And at times, Luther can speak of the kingdom of the world in almost this Johannine sense of world, which is sort of everything that's opposed to God and everything that's opposed to God's will. Although for John, that specifically has to do with the opposition to the gospel and the opposition to Christ. But in any case, sometimes Luther can speak of the kingdom of the world as the kingdom of Satan. However, the world is also God's, right? It's the sphere of God's activity. So it shouldn't be simply sort of reduced to something that belongs to the devil or something like that, okay? So Luther at times can also speak of the whole world as the sphere of God's activity. Well, I mean, if we go with Luther, Satan is always God's Satan. In other words, Satan is not, you know, sort of in this Star Wars kind of duel with God, always seeing, you know, who wins against the other in an eternal struggle that never ends. Unless, of course, you go to with the Hollywood version of things and good always triumphs over evil, you know. But after a long kind of struggle. No, God can also use and does use and subdue Satan and his demons to bring about his own purposes in the world. So when you think of the kingdom of the world, don't think only sort of kingdom of the devil. Luther can use that, but it seems like Luther prefers actually more the language of kingdom of grace. And then he'll talk about also the world as God's sphere of activity. Okay. All right, so now let's move into some of the perhaps questions that a theology of the two kingdoms or two governments are actually asking. Okay, if I were to ask the question, where does God rule in the world? Okay, the world, the sphere of God's works and activity. Where does He rule? I could answer in two realms or spheres of life. There are people who prefer the term realms when talking about doctrine of the two kingdoms. Two kingdoms. And I don't know exactly all the reasons for it. I think maybe part of it is because sometimes kingdom of the world refers only to, in some cases, to sort of the sphere of Satan's activity or something like that. But Luther often wants to say, no, the whole world is God's and God's in control and rules, but in two different realms or spheres of life. And in one sphere of life, He will rule through the sword, in another sphere of life, he will rule through his word and gospel. But we'll get to that in a little bit. If I were to ask the question, how or in what way does God rule in these two realms? Well, one may say through his two governments. On the one hand, he rules in the temporal realm, also at times called the left-hand realm. And there he does it through the sword. God also governs in the spiritual realm, and there he does it through the word, which, at least if you go to the book of Ephesians, is referred also as a sword, but in this case it would be a spiritual sword, I suppose. So God rules or governs the whole world with power through the sword, and that is the sphere of the temporal governing of God. But God also rules by his grace, and he does that through the word of Christ, the word that points to Christ, the word of grace, and that's God's spiritual governing. Now, in both cases, whether you're talking about the temporal realm or the spiritual realm, God's establishing of justice in the world through the sword, or God's establishing of righteousness before God through the forgiveness of sins through the gospel, it is always God the one who is governing. And often, and always, one might say actually, always governing against everything that opposes his good will for creation. So God always governs the whole world. He rules against Satan's kingdom. And by doing so, by ruling in the temporal and spiritual realms, God blesses us. It is a good thing to live in times of peace. That is a blessing. It is a good thing to sort of walk around with some relative security, because people just can't come up and do whatever they want to you. Well, those who try will most likely hear from the authorities about it and perhaps receive some punishment, you know. But it's something that makes you think twice. So here the so-called first use or political use of the law is certainly a blessing. Okay? And of course, we know the blessings that come to us through the forgiveness of sins, reconciliation with God. So God blesses the whole world in both the temporal and the spiritual realms of his activity. Okay? The Christian lives and works in both. And this is not easy to conceive. A pastor or a deaconess will have the type of vocation that will promote the consolation of people through the gospel, of the forgiveness of sins. That will just come with the territory. The same is true of a mother who speaks the gospel to her children, or the couple who proclaims the forgiveness of sins to one another after some major fight at the home, each one according to their own vocation, becomes a bearer of good news to another. And God is ruling through his gospel in those cases. But those same people have responsibilities
in relationship to their neighbor that may be put under what's called the temporal realm. All right? So being a mother, that's an office established by God. Okay? Being husband and wife, those are offices established by God through the institution of marriage. And you could speak of the economy as an extension of the family, the household economy. Government, also instituted, established by God. So on the one hand, you could be the pastor in the congregation, but as a citizen of the world, you will also go and exercise your vote at the next election, I hope. So again, the Christian lives and works in both realms. And we'll get into a discussion of how this is actually at times more difficult than you think. But before we do that, we should make some basic distinctions here to make sure that we can properly speak of what we mean by God's two governments. First, in the temporal government, God rules with his law. And by law here, I want us to think of primarily what is, I guess, called the political use of the law, or the first use, which restrains people from gross manifestations of sin in the world, but which also rewards and promotes active righteousness, you might say, promotes justice in the world. Fairness, peace, all of that good stuff. But God rules in the temporal government with the law. So the law, even when you think about the political use, the law is a good thing. I mean, it doesn't save you. The second use of the law does bring you to a recognition of sin. That's the theological use of the law. Professor Kolb was talking about this last time. But even the political use of the law that restrains people from sin, or from gross manifestations of sin in the world and so on, that's a good thing. Okay? It is God's goodwill for creation. In some ways, it's just as good as the laws of nature, right? In other words, you know that it's pretty good if you don't jump off a bridge, you know, because you know what's going to happen, right? So you kind of know your limits. The law sets some limits, okay? Can't just be going around murdering people, right? That's a no-no, okay? Shouldn't be going around committing adultery and having more than one wife. Okay? It's not good for the family. Okay? The law is good. We often think of the law as, I suppose, you know, a burden. Well, yeah, of course, you know. It tells you what to do and not to do, but that's also good. It's only because we're sinful still in this life that we have a hard time seeing the law as good. But God knows the limits that he sets upon his creation, and he does that for our own good. In the spiritual government, God rules with the gospel. Now here you could bring the law too, I suppose, in the theological usage, because by despairing of your own efforts, one looks to the merits of Christ alone for forgiveness. And so you could bring as a presupposition here, or you can assume the second use of the law here in the spiritual realm. Okay, but it is the gospel that does the transformation. The law may show you your sin, but it will not deliver you from it. Okay? It's a prelude to the gospel which does the reconciliation and the absolution. All right? So that's one distinction you want to make between the temporal and spiritual governments. How does God bring about his rule? How is he governing? Also, in the temporal government, the idea is to promote what we have been calling here righteousness before others. Okay? Coram mundo, coram hominibus. Righteousness before the world, righteousness before others. And this actually applies, just like God's law applies, to all people, the whole world. Okay? This is not just the Christians or something like that. Okay? This is for the whole world. Okay? Sometimes a distinction is made between, you know, sanctifying righteousness, which is this referred to more in terms of the Christian life, sanctification or something like that. Because the presupposition is that follows from justification. And who's to justify but the one who's been brought to God through faith in Christ? So I guess in a sense you could talk about Christian active righteousness as sanctifying righteousness or as sanctification, because it presupposes that you're talking about the justified, okay? But that is not to say that in the case of those who are not Christians, you can't talk about active righteousness. You can talk about active righteousness too. This is why you will probably, as I was telling my sectional the other day, you will probably love to have a Mormon neighbor move next door. You know, because, I mean, they're pretty good people. They probably don't leave the garbage out for weeks, so you have to smell it on a hot summer day, you know. And besides that, you know, a lot of those guys tend to keep their bodies in shape. They don't drink or smoke. Or, you know, you might actually like the Mormon neighbor better than your Christian neighbor who lives across the street, who doesn't pick up his garbage, who probably drinks a little bit more than he should. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. You appreciate active righteousness. You want to promote it. We think it's a good thing. Okay? Well, God's rule in the temporal realm, God's governing in the temporal realm, promotes active righteousness. You know, it's good for everybody. Look, if you do good things to get along with your neighbor, you're going to have a pretty happy life. We often also hear the horror stories about neighbors who don't get along too well, and they live a miserable existence. Active righteousness is a good thing. Okay? In the spiritual realm, God's governing promotes righteousness before God, Coram Deo, through Christ. Okay, and that is brought about through the gospel. Okay. All right, so that is the particular task of those who work in positions of authority under God's spiritual government. Okay, now in the temporal government, God preserves creation. And how does he preserve creation? Well, he uses civil authority in the world so that they might apply the law. So sometimes you will be coerced to do certain things that you don't want to do, I suppose, like, you know, speeding because you have to get somewhere quickly. Well, you know, you don't always take your foot off the pedal because you're purely motivated by the gospel to do it, right? Because you see the police car. We got to see it in time. Oh, okay. Which probably is a good thing. So you don't hit another car or even kill someone because of reckless driving. So God preserves his creation, okay? So the fact that he rules through the law in society to restrain wickedness and promote justice You know, it's a good thing. It's a way that he preserves the world. This is why concern about nuclear proliferation and things like that is actually pretty good, a pretty good form of active righteousness. Humans are such that they could blow up the world if not watched. All right? So there is a lot to this. God preserves the world, okay, through the law, through active righteousness, promotion of justice, restraining, ordering society. But we are to think of this also as a blessing in other ways, like, for example, the fact that we have government, that we have marriage, that we have schools, businesses. I mean, these are all forms of what we might call vocations, stations in life, orders in creation, all of which are forms in which God blesses his people. It's kind of nice to be able to go buy something somewhere that you need. Hopefully, you know, hopefully you appreciate what you have. Sometimes we have way too much that we no longer see that God is the one who's given us all things. You know, when you don't have to grow up your own crops and you just go to the supermarket, you know, you don't get the sense of appreciation for things like the farmer in Iowa does, who depends for his livelihood on the rain or whatever that year, you know. So I think sometimes we just kind of take those things for granted, you know. But God does create ways and orders creation in a way that the neighbor is served. And ideally, in ways that no one will have to go hungry or go without clothing. This is how God has structured the world, that we may serve one another. Now, we don't always want to do it. And here is where, when that happens, it's good for the law to restrain us. Yeah, go ahead. How is it helpful to the redemption for creation? Yeah. Mm-hmm. All you. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mhm. Right, right. Mhm. Right. Yeah. So what do you do with the rest of the Coram Mundo, right? Because typically we talk about the Coram Hominibus, righteousness before man kind of thing. Well, that's a good question, but I think any time that question is asked, it's probably best to see it in relationship to mankind. So, for example, when we argue for active righteousness and law in the temporal realm for things like you know, preserving renewable sources of energy and things like that. Often the argument that is made, which I think is pretty good, is that this will help our neighbor in some way. You see, it will not sort of overburden our resources, you know, buying oil or something like that, because now we have another resource. And perhaps, you know, that could help us serve our neighbor better, you know. Now, of course, there are people who argue on the goodness of creation merely on the basis of the fact that it is there and it exists. And sometimes that goes pretty far when you go with some of these kind of neo-pagan justifications of Mother Earth, and you know, every time that you do something, you know, Mother Earth suffers and things like that. You know, and there is no real connection to the earth and those whom God has placed on the earth to administer and to benefit from it. So I think when we talk about righteousness coram mundo, we do want to uphold things like care and of the environment, administration of the creation God has given us. But for what purpose, we have to ask? You know, what would be the purpose for doing that? And I would hope that in any discussion of active righteousness, your neighbor has a place in the discussion. So preservation of God's creation by affirming the care of the environment is a good thing, because you're thinking about specifically how this is going to affect your neighbor. You know, so for example, destruction of the Amazon rainforest is going to affect Indian populations living in the area. It's going to affect pollution. It's going to bring pollution. It's going to affect food for the area or the population along the Amazon River. So what are you going to do about that? You know. Also, the Amazon is referred to as a big part of the lungs of the earth, right? So you take some of that out, it's going to affect you in some ways. So how do you uphold the care for the environment, the administration of creation, in a way that it doesn't lead to some form of idolatry or something like that towards Mother Earth, but rather that it directs you to the neighbor? You know, so coram mundo has to bring that in. Now, in terms of the redemption of the world, one of the things that we should keep in mind here is that the rest of creation suffers the effects of human sin in the world. You know, it wasn't the animals or the trees, okay, that fell. So the real problem is you and I. So this is why when people want to bring, you know, pets to church and, you know, bless my pet and my animal. Well, I mean, there might be some place for that, okay? But the ones who should really be going to church is you and I. We're the ones who got everyone else and everything else in trouble. And so this is why Paul in Romans 8 can talk about how creation yearns for the whose redemption? Our redemption. Okay? Because when we are taken care of, okay, everything else will be fine and creation will no longer be subjected, not only to our use, but to our abuse. So, I mean, there is a real sense here in which God's work in the temporal, or excuse me, God's work in the spiritual realm, will also, at least in terms of fulfillment, bring about its fruits for the rest of creation, although we don't really know what that's going to look like. Okay? Yeah. Well, the only example I can think of would be Romans 8, where creation benefits from the redemption of, you know, the rest of humanity, those whom God has made his sons in that context, you know. But there is always in terms of the fulfillment of something that we're expecting yet and that we don't see, you know. So I don't know exactly what an anticipation or a not yet of redemption and its effects on creation would look like today. I mean,
in regards to that God preserves creation through civil authority and the law, like, how do you deal with the conflict when civil authority makes laws that don't preserve creation?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or against the environment or something like that, yeah. Well, I mean, that's one of those, and we're going to get into this a little bit later because we do have to look at precisely this kind of question. The easy preliminary answer to this is that it refers to a little something I said at the beginning of the lecture, and that is that you always have to give honor and respect sort of the office that God has established for your own good. There is a guy who talks about, what's his name again? I think it's, was it Gustav Wengren, maybe? In the book on Lutheran vocation. He says, you know, that God can even bless you through a tyrant. I mean, sometimes we think of even people, or you might say something like, you know, Hugo Chavez, you know, boo, you know, bad guy, you know. But you go to Venezuela and you talk to some of these people. First of all, they voted for the guy. You know. Secondly, the country was deeply steeped in corruption and had been for many, many years. And so when that happens, you know that there's going to be a strong hand kind of guy. He's going to say it's going to be the end of that. Well, people are going to go for that. I mean, that just, you know, and it doesn't help to be anti-American, actually. Anywhere in the world, for that matter, you know. It'll probably get you elected. You're supposed to laugh. Anyways, but... good. But the thing is, does that mean that you have to agree with every law that comes out of Chavez's government? See, one thing is to... And the other thing is, one thing is what God is able to do to rule, even through wicked rulers or whatever, you know. And another thing is, what you're going to do for your neighbor. So there are times when you will be in conflict with the law of the land because you see that your neighbor is suffering greatly. You mentioned the case of abortion. You know, now, does that mean that you're going to go and overthrow the president or kill the doctors who do abortions? No, you still respect the office and the vocations they have been given. But in that which you believe goes against the implementation of God's law and will for humanity, you can still be opposed to it. And you can work towards, you know, dealing with that situation. I mean, I suppose in the case of the United States, the vote could be a powerful tool, you know, if you think that there's things that, you know, that do not jive with sort of God's will for creation. So there's a distinction here to be made between God's orders of creation, God's institution of government, God's office, and whoever is in the office at this or that time, and the laws that might come out of it that do not jive with God's commandments. So a Christian can perform, I suppose, acts of civil disobedience if they are absolutely convinced that the law of the land goes against the law of God. Okay? So, but we can talk a little bit more about that. Okay? But at least the preliminary way is, in that which God has not commanded, you're not supposed to just go, because this or that guy said so. But you know, but then there's a balance there. So it's good to distinguish between office, you know. I mean, we don't like a lot of people who are in certain offices, okay? But God still works through them. And I should say even through them in opposition even at times to them. Okay, so it is good to recognize at one level that God is always in charge, you know. But it's also good to ask the question, how is the law blessing my neighbor? Because if the law is being used in a way that it oppresses my neighbor and is unjust, you know, as a citizen, you have to be able to argue that this is not good for the people. This is not good for my neighbor. This is not good for the nations.
So,
you know, it's the case of abortion is one. Also, you know, celebrating Martin Luther King Day. I mean, the whole thing about the rights of African Americans and others in this country. The issue of immigration also comes up, you know. What do you do about that? We'll have some case studies on that. It's not as easy as you think. So, respect for the law, respect for the office, respect for the government, honor, and doesn't mean that you make the law into an idol, or this or that law into an idol, or this or that office into some kind of an idol. Yeah. All right, let's see. How are we doing? Okay. Now, who exactly does God rule through in both realms? Well, how does he rule? He rules through the law, also rules through the gospel in the temporal and then the spiritual realm. But who does he rule through? And here it's helpful to think of Luther's discussion of those who fulfill their vocations as mass of God. So, if the pastor absolves you from your sins, you ought to hear him as if God himself is speaking through him, right? This is the catechism answer to absolution. Well, you know, I would hear my mother and father the same way. Anytime they said something to me, it was as if God himself was speaking. Because guess what? It is. This is the whole idea of the mask of God. Okay? God is at work through people whom he has put into vocations to bless you, to protect you, you know. I feel like I've saved my son's life at least 3 times. Okay? When I speak, you know, especially when my tone of voice goes a little higher, I hope that, you know, it feels like God is speaking to him at that point, you know, if he hasn't before. I mean, it's for his own good. Now, do I make mistakes? Yes. See? I can mess it up. This or that guy can mess it up. But God can bless even through a tyrant. Now, that's the faith we put in God, the one who creates and preserves all things. Now, that doesn't mean that if my friend's son is being abused, so I'm not going to do anything about it because I respect the office. So, see, this is another situation where you ask whether the mask of God is actually applying the law to the benefit of your neighbor. So you have to make calls like that, you know. But you still respect the office of father and mother. This is why you don't throw papers at your teacher when he turns around to explain something. You might not think the world of me, but I've been put here by God to teach you something. Now, you might not even agree with my teaching, but you honor the office. If you don't, I'll punish you in your final exam. I can do that too. It's not all gospel, you know. There's a lot of temporal authority going on here, you know. Yeah, go ahead. Yes. Yeah, I think that could be the case, yeah. This is why I think, you know, it's important to, it's kind of a two-way thing here. On the one hand, there has to be some trust here that God is really king. Okay? So there's got to be place for the idea that God knows best. At the same time, there has to be room for the idea of, I think I know what God's will perhaps should look like or not, you know. And so if there are certain, you know, policies that clearly and perhaps even overtly are going to hurt the greatest number of people or something like that, well, I hope that someone will have discerned that already, you know, at some point, yeah. But we have to also be careful that we just don't kind of individually, you know, that everyone is going to, well, say, well, you know,
I think that this is wrong, and this is wrong, and this is wrong, you know. So we, at some point, we have to be able to distinguish between sort of personal preferences, personal politics, personal philosophies, and the idea that what's important in some ways is, first, that we give honor and promote those things which God has already established, you know. And so it is good to promote marriage in a society. It is good to promote civil authority in a society. And so not to go against them because of perhaps a personal preference, or to go against them because I am not being served, okay? Perhaps you will pay more taxes if you make more money. Maybe that's maybe something that you should suffer. I don't know. Because, you know, maybe it will help a greater number of people. I don't know. You can always argue this stuff, you know. So I think there are a lot of things that you could argue for, but I think there are situations where you might actually be able to make a claim that the greatest number of people here are being being oppressed or something like that. Something should be done. Or there are situations where you might want to argue, what's happening right now with our government is not allowing for the proclamation of the gospel. Okay? And so government is encroaching upon the church. And as someone who has a vocation in the church, we can't allow that to happen. You know, this is sort of what happened in L.A. when they were thinking about immigration law, and one of the proposals was that the church could be criminalized, all right, if they provided help to illegal immigrants and you know, did otherwise things that the church does. I mean, the church is the arm of mercy because that flows out of her proclamation of the gospel. So I think it was a Catholic bishop called people to civil disobedience. Because, I mean, first of all, you're talking about L.A., right, which is like, what, 60% Latino or something like that, or 40-something percent Latino at least. And the mayor happens to be one, too. So when you're talking about the city of L.A., you're talking about the bishop who works with these people all the time. Well, that sort of becomes his neighbor in some ways. But he saw that as an encroachment of the state, telling the church what they could, to criminalize them for being church. My goodness, you know. Well, what do you do in something like that? Okay? So, you saw what happened. You know. So, there is room for that, you know. So, I don't know, you know. It's one of those things where you don't want everyone to just be thinking of themselves or what's best for them. But hopefully, when people think about whether politics is working or not, they're looking at everyone else and not just them. See, you thought that politics was just about being Democrat or Republican. It's not. You're supposed to have your neighbor in view. That should be, neighbor is above political affiliation. Always. It's even above personal philosophy. Mm-hmm. It's hard to be a Christian living in the temporal realm. All right, so, who does God rule through? His mass or co-workers in the context of very concrete vocations. Gustav Wingren, in his book Lutheran Vocation, writes, man's action is a medium for God's love to others. In the exercise of his vocation, man becomes a mask of God. What then is Christian vocation? It is the concrete context in an activity through which Christians love their neighbor and thus actually fulfill the law of God. So, you know what the law of God is, right? Ten Commandments. Now, how do I fulfill the Ten Commandments? Well, you can get at it in a very abstract kind of way and just kind of go through it, each one of them. And the Catechism, to some extent, does that. And when we ask to be examine ourselves before we take the Lord's Supper, you know, that's one of the ways that's suggested. Think of the commandments, how I've broken them, and all of that stuff. But when it comes to the temporal realm and our work in the sphere of active righteousness, what does fulfilling the law look like? That's going to be different for everyone, the form that that takes. All right, the way that a mother fulfills the law, well, that's a very specific way of loving your neighbor. Okay, the way the teacher does it. Okay, the way the student does it. The way the legislator does it. The way that the baker does it. They all look different, but they are all serving their neighbor. They are all fulfilling the law in a very concrete context. So sometimes when we ask questions like, you know, what's my purpose, you know, the purpose-driven life, you know, what's the purpose for my life? Well, the first thing is, look at the neighbor God has placed in your midst and get busy with your vocation. Any number of us has already been put in a relationship to another, some relationship where you can't drop the ball. People depend on you and you depend on others. Okay? God has already given you that. Everyone is born into some kind of relationship. Everyone is in some kind of vocation. You don't need anything else. You don't need to look for some other kind of will of God in your life. Get busy with what you have already. Okay? Vocation is a concrete form of fulfilling the law. In a sense, the law cannot be fulfilled apart from any vocation. Now, it is also true that the law is above any particular vocation, right? Because, in other words, if you see someone on the street suffering, you're not going to say, well, let's see, you don't really fit into any of my vocations. Well, of course you wouldn't do that, right? You're not my father, you're not my brother, you don't do that. So on the one hand, what does it mean to fulfill the law and do the will of God? Look at the relationships God has placed you in. Look at your vocation or vocations in life. And I guarantee you, if you get busy with those, there is no time for anything else. You wouldn't want to be looking for another will of God for your life because there's just no time for it. And at the same time, the law of love, in a sense, is above law in that you can't just say, unless you fit in my vocation, then I'll see how I can help you. Vocation is God's calling to each Christian to serve their neighbor through one or various created orders. Created orders be institution of marriage, institution of government, institution of the ministry of the gospel. God's calling to serve the neighbor in our specific vocation, stations, offices. Any number of offices, vocations, flow out of these created orders, right? So for the institution of marriage, mother, father, son, daughter, grandma, grandpa, all this kind of stuff. Out of the household, out of the economy of the household, you have what we call business. Well, there you have employee, employer, right? CEO, whatever, you know. Then you have government, legislators, okay? Mayors, citizens, okay? Police. Firefighters. See? All that good stuff that flows out of. And at any point in time in history, the vocations might look different. The creator orders remain the same. The vocations look different. They take different form. Because what drives vocation in some ways is the orders, but also the specific form they take to serve your neighbor at this or that time in history. Okay, we're almost, it's almost time to go here. So we'll just ask if you have any more questions for today, and then next time we'll go a little bit more into created orders, vocation. And then when vocations come into conflict with one another, you got to serve two neighbors. What gives in? That's a tough one. Also, we're going to talk about the confusion between the two realms. Sometimes we confuse the two, their task, their purpose,
gets us into trouble. And then we'll have some case studies to discuss. Okay? So we'll see you on Thursday.